have a little mechanical ability, too.
I like to make sure it's running. But I don't see the tape. It's running.
Okay.
All right. I'm Paula Rome, and I'm here with Pete Maroudis in his office in the Federal Building, and we're here to talk about McKeldin and Pete's time with McKeldin and how it all relates to civil rights in the late 60s. Maybe I better stop, check, and make sure we're recording. Now, how did it come to be that you went to work for McKeldin?
Well, in early 1967, which was really the last year of his term, Mr. McKeldin's chief administrative assistant, Richard Andrews, who previously had been deputy director for the Baltimore Urban Renewal and Housing Agency, had decided to take a job in New Castle County, Delaware, to run the county government up there. And you know, one day Mr. Andrews called me in his office and indicated to me if I had any interest in replacing him. And it was totally unexpected. I really had no... I was at that time working as a government and political reporter for the Baltimore Evening Sun, and had been assigned to city government from December 1963 until that period. So I'd been there over 3 years covering city government, and of course Mayor McKeldin was the mayor for that entire period. And Dick Andrews indicated to me that he was the mayor was thought a lot about me and had a great deal of respect for me, and thought that I would be the person to who could handle the job. I had no previous government experience except that I was familiar with the city hall operation, having been assigned there as a reporter for 3 years. So I then discussed it with the mayor briefly after Board of Estimates one day and a meeting one day, and then I thought about it a little bit, and then I decided I would do it. The question in my mind at the time as to whether, well, I've kind of figured that the mayor wouldn't run again for re-election, and that if I just stayed for the next 10, 11 months, that it would be valuable experience to me to have worked as a chief aide to the mayor of the sixth largest city in the country. And as I found out later, that Mr. McKeldin had discussed the matter with Mr. D'Alessandro, who he had envisioned as being his successor, and had hoped, I mean, it was nothing, no firm, but had hoped that Mr. D'Alessandro, would he become mayor, would keep me on, and which indeed he did. And I was grateful to Mr. McKeldin for that time for worrying about my future. So that's how I came to go to work for him. I'd never been involved with him politically in any way. I'm not a native Baltimorean. I came here from Detroit to work for the Sun in early 1963, although I do have many ties to Baltimore. I have many, many relatives. In fact, outside of Detroit, my hometown, the city with most of my relatives is Baltimore. So I vacation. I mean, I came here frequently as a child, frequently every summer for 10 years practically. So I'm not a stranger to the city. It was not in that sense, but stranger in a public sense in terms of any public involvement. So that's how I came to work for him.
Yeah. Was there something specific, do you think, that McKeldin was looking to you for?
Well, no, I guess he thought, one, that I knew the operation of the city government, and two, I think he pretty well, he was comfortable, I think, or I was comfortable with his particular governmental philosophy. I think that everybody who'd held the job, he really professionalized the operation of the mayor's office in his second term. to a greater degree than it had ever been professionalized, and the successors, the predecessors to me had generally been people who agreed with the mayor's, well, all agreed with the mayor's philosophy of government. So although I was a registered Republican, I think everyone who held, a Democrat rather, I'm sorry, everyone who held the job was a Democrat. That didn't really make any difference to the mayor, however. So I think that he felt that I knew the job. My one fear was that I had no previous experience. Mm-hmm. I just went right into an administrative position, a chief administrative position, without any previous experience. But he was good because he really gave you good. I mean, he's good, and if you like to work that way, he was not a detail man. He just gave you very broad parameters of policy within which you would work, and it was up to you to fill those in. So he was very, very removed in many ways from the day-to-day operations. He wanted the big policy issues, and then you had to translate them into concrete, tangible governmental actions. And that's the way he operated.
And if he were not pleased with what your solution to a problem, you'd have to go back and work
yeah.
it again, or he took it as it came? Or?
He generally took it as it came. He gave his people really tremendous latitude to operate. That's the way he always did. If he was upset, he'd tell you, but, you know, he felt, for instance, I came in there very fresh and new. I had a great deal of trepidation and really questions as to really what if I could do the job. I think it would be natural. I'd never been in even near that kind of a position, and he just had a way of extracting, or I guess the word is from you, at least what I think of a high level of performance and dedication. He really had a way about that.
Which is in itself a
yeah.
strength.
Yeah, it was. It was quite interesting. I mean, he just, I think a lot of that is just, he was very much a person who, you know, it's not always true, but he had very humble beginnings, and he never forgot about where he came from, and I think he always gave the benefit of the doubt to the person working for him. I mean, he could get mad, but he gave you the benefit of the doubt. So if you made a mistake, you know.
Good trying, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. yeah.
All right. Before we get going on the civil rights, let's talk a little bit about McKeldin's accomplishments in other areas. What other issues or projects were particularly important to him? What other new ground do you feel he broke during his second administration?
Well, the Inner Harbor, of course, is the. It's the completion of the Charleston, but the Inner Harbor, which was his idea, undoubtedly. And we're seeing the fruition of it now.
Hopefully,
yeah. Well, McKeldin was a man who dealt in big visions, as I said. You know, he really had vision. He had an idea where the city ought to go, and the way that he did, the way the state ought to go. Mm-hmm. I mean, both in, I guess, the physical areas, developmental areas, which the Inner Harbor, and then in the non-physical, in the human rights area, which, you know, civil rights, and housing, which cuts both ways, you know. But he spoke with vision. You could see him looking forward. You could see him looking forward when he spoke. Is kind of unique in a way for mayors. There's no way to disparage any of the other mayors, but they're more nuts and bolts, mm-hmm. more generally mayors, generally, not always, but generally mayors, you know, are very, they've got to be concerned with the day-to-day operation of government, producing the services. And McKeldin was not a governmental technician. He left that to other people. He wanted to look at the big picture. So the Inner Harbor, of course, is really was really his landmark. In that he felt, and I know he felt that it was,
mm-hmm.
and
On what basis? Just that a city...
He felt that it was the natural growth asset, the natural growth of the Charles Center, that the city had to really redevelop its... It's how, after all, he said, you know, that's where the city started, and that's where its rebirth ought to continue.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds. I think that... That, and of course, he put great emphasis in the areas of housing, and... You know, we had Dick Steiner over at the Urban Renewal Agency.
He
was the national director. And Marty Mills Palm. And so he put a great emphasis. And one thing about McKeldin, he would say it. You know, he'd always say, I'm a high tax man.
Uh-huh.
He'd say
his programs cost money.
He'd say they cost money. He used to talk about the University of Maryland. He's, you know, if he didn't spend the money with the governor, when he was governor, it wouldn't be there. He always had said, if you listen to the people who said, don't spend, and you follow that to its logical consequence, then nothing would happen at all. There'd be no university. It would just be like a business. He said, you could never operate a business if you didn't
Without
spend money.
Putting capital.
You have to spend money in order to make money, in order to develop the people's capacities and talents. He always felt that he had to spend money. The other thing that really comes to my mind, too, is his perception of the city, of what the city's function was. You know, Mr. McKeldin was not a scholar in the traditional sense, in that he had great degrees, possessed great formal education. He did not. But he was a scholar more in the truer sense. I mean, he really gleaned from history certain lessons or axioms or what have you. As you know, he was a great, you know, scholar of the Old and New Testament.
Yeah.
And he viewed the city as, he used to give this famous speech, and the other people can tell you, he'd say, look, they talk about the poor and the minorities who would come in the city. He said, we want them to come. This is where they can come and enter the mainstream of American life. This is where their options open up for them. Where they were, their options were limited, or there were no options. So that he said the city was always historically provide the role of bringing in those who, I can't remember his exact words, but those who were at the bottom of the ladder, or those who had who were most impoverished, or those that the city provided that vehicle for them to move upwards or really to develop themselves and enter the mainstream of society. He believed very strongly in that. He says, they come from Appalachia. He says, they come from the areas in the South. And he welcomed that as a challenge. You know, he saw that as the historical role the city ought to provide, not only in the physical sense, but in a spiritual sense, would bring people together.
So that in terms of his civil rights policies, this would be a natural...
That's right, exactly, you see. that's right. In other words, his perception of what a city ought to be would include then, you know, a strong commitment to civil rights in order to give people opportunity in order to release their energies and talents for their own good and for the good of the community and for the good of the country. He really believed in that, and that this was the place that the city traditionally provided that function, that vehicle for people to come in and move out. He cited the immigrants, the great immigrations from Europe in the 1800s and the early 1900s. Where did the immigration come? Most of it came to the cities. You know, and so that the city absorbed and did that job, and then now it was the white and black immigrants from Appalachia in the South. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll get on to his civil rights later, but I have a couple other questions for you. First, what was McKeldin's relationship to the Democratic Party? How did he get his legislation through?
Well, unfortunately, the person who could best answer that is deceased, and that's Bill Adelson, Emily Adelson, who was his closest and really, I think, only political confidant. and who really handled all of the mayor's politics. I don't believe the mayor handled very little politics. I had absolutely no political responsibilities, mm-hmm. none, as his chief administrative assistant. Maybe some of the others did, but before me, but I don't think they did either. Or if they were, they were minimal. But Bill Adelson was the person who handled all of the mayor's and as governor's political responsibilities. I guess you could go back and talk to people like Louis Goldstein. I think he was president of the Senate when McKeldin was governor. And he might be able to, people like
what
that.
What the machinations were.
Right, of how Mr. McKeldin had friendly relations generally with the Democratic political leaders, if you were against him politically, he never disparaged his political opponents, mm-hmm. because he felt he kind of needed them in a practical sense. So he always generally had his majorities in the council. I think he would try to, at the beginning of a session, would try to make sure that he had his majorities and that he had a working majority in order to get his programs through. And that was Mr. Adelson's job,
mm-hmm.
In talking and lobbying and working with the various political factions whose representatives were in the city council, at the time. So he enjoyed generally good relationships.
Yeah. He'd had to have.
Several with him. I think several he didn't get along with too well personally.
Want to elaborate on that?
No, I mean, it's just, something he didn't like. But he generally was quite successful in getting his programs.
Do you think to any extent his courtship of minorities had to do with his knowing that he was a member of a minority party and needed all the votes he could get, or is that a...
No, I don't think so. I think that his courtship of minorities, stemmed from a couple of reasons. One was his basic commitment. And two, I think it was politically, that was an area he could go to that was open to him. He put together coalitions of people, but I don't think it stemmed from that. I think that he put together coalitions of... He was very strong in the black community, of course, which had a traditionally Republican orientation until Roosevelt, with the Jewish community, with a kind of anti-machine Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had his own vote, too, in East Baltimore as well. He'd go to all the ethnic affairs and everything, so he had a sensitivity to that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the word I think I want to use. He had a sensitivity to the various ethnic and religious minorities.
He did.
Extremely. He knew how to strike the responsive chords.
Without seeming...
You're patronizing it.
Without, right, exactly. You mentioned Bill Adelson. How about some of his other advisors? Who were they, and to what extent did they influence him?
Well, I came at the tail end of his career, so I can't speak with great knowledge, but I would say that you'd put Bill Adelson, of course, as a chief of... like Joseph Allen, who was in the last 4 years, he probably was his most important day-to-day advisor and most important advisor on policy in general.
He was city solicitor.
Yes, right, and he was right next to him at the Board of Estimates meetings every Wednesday, which were the important policy-making decisions were made publicly. And the judge really was really the important advisor in the last 4 years on a day-to-day basis. And of course, then he had people like Simon Soboloff, who was his longtime friend and associate, who was extremely important. Gene Feinblatt, attorney Eugene Feinblatt, chairman of the Urban Renewal Commission during the McKeldin administration. Uh, of some others that he, Al Sugar, who's now retired in Florida.
What did he advise?
Al was close to him politically. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, Al Sugar.
Anyway,
yeah, he's retired now in Florida. Very close friend of Viktor Frankl.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. McKeldin was close to Viktor Frankl. They didn't advise him as much, I guess, as they were helpful to him politically. But Sobolov and Allen, Abel Wallman, over at the Hopkins. Gerald Johnson used to write speeches for the for McKeldin when he really needed a good speech. And Gerald Johnson was another person, but I'm sure there's others that, you know, I know Al Quinn, who the late Al Quinn, who's ended his career at BAL, who was his chief press person, and Adelson. Adelson was a legal as well as a political advisor too. Also, you know, he had in Sobolov, Allen, Adelson, you know, just tremendous legal and political talent. You know, really fine black. Leon Sachs.
Mm-hmm.
Leon Sachs, a very important person to talk to, I think. I forgot Leon Sachs. Leon Sachs was one of those people who, you know, is one of those bridge. He spans, very active in labor as a mediator, you know, and in the Jewish community. Leon Sachs was one that McKeldin would always call in to troubleshoot the labor problems.
He had a talent for drawing really, really bright.
I mean, I'm saying that as a self-serving savior, but he really he did. He had that talent. How he just could spot people, and so those people were kind of his. You know, as the one that I mentioned: Adelson, Sobolov, Allen. Wallman, Sachs, Feinblatt were kind of a continuing cadre of advisors in the background. And then other persons would come in, you know, Steiner and Housing.
Yeah.
And his administrative assistants were in and out, kind of. Yeah.
All right. What about McKeldin's relationship with Agnew?
Well,
was it a source of great frustration? I know their approaches were so different on civil rights matters, for example.
Well, they got to be different. Agnew's approach was not much different in many ways than McKeldin's, really. I mean, you got to look at Agnew's record in Baltimore County. It was not a bad record.
No blacks in Baltimore County.
No, but I mean, he pushed for certain things that were construed.
Open housing?
Yeah, well, no urban renewal. You recall that Agnew lost tremendously. That's when the John Birch Society came and poured money in people, and when Agnew sought to develop an urban renewal program in the county, Mr. Wabi was then the director, who is now presently secretary of the state department. Planning was the urban renewal director, and Agnew lost that referendum 3-1. And then he tried to strengthen the Human Relations Commission in the county. So it's, at least it observably, he was starting from the more moderate, I guess, wing of the Republican Party.
I think I had forgotten all that.
Oh, yeah. Well, really, I think in fairness that people ought to, you know, look at the total, you know, look at Agnew, you know, he's, most people look at him beginning in 68 when he made that he dressed down the black leaders during the riots of 68. But so I think that he didn't, he felt that Agnew was lacking in ability. Mm. Yeah. But that he had lacking in ability. But his approach to Mr. Agnew was to all that he was the governor, he was important to the city, and that, you know, you should try to generate a response from Mr. Agnew that was positive. And one thing that McKeldin always did, and it was interesting, and is that he always believed that you know, everybody was a creature of God. Believe very strongly that, you know, the brotherhood of man and the fatherhood of God was one of his favorite expressions, and that he translated that into his daily dealings, so that if a person who was critical or abusive or insulting to him or his policy, he always tried to find a way to elicit a more positive response from the person. And then, you know, people would come and shout sometime in City Hall, and I'd say, well, we can't see these people. They're coming down here and yelling and screaming. He says, well, if they weren't, the fact that they are here yelling and screaming indicates that they're interested, that they have a commitment to something. Now, we have to see how we can channel that commitment into something constructive and positive. So, you know, it was in that he recognized that each person in each kind of group had their own particular dignity and integrity. And, I mean, that's what I learned from him.
Mm-hmm. Which is not to say that he never yelled and screamed.
No.
No, he was...
But in public, he rarely ever did. He might have attempted, but in public, he rarely ever did. Yeah. Occasionally. And it was, you know, it would happen, but... He gets somebody else to do the yelling, like Judge Allen.
Well, no, I would say I was going to ask you pointedly about his motivation and the source of his civil rights views and concerns, but I would think that between the notion of his, what you were just speaking about, his sense of the dignity of man and his ideas about cities and...
Well, other people could tell you, but I think it was primarily based on his religious commitment. I mean, Mr. McKeldin was generally a religious man. I mean, he wasn't a person who practiced that public kind of religion. I mean, he really believed. And I believe that from what I can, and others may be able to speak, you know, obviously that I was not a contemporary. But I think that that religious belief then combined, it was translated into a sense of social conscience. He believed in the Republican Party as well, as that it was the Republican Party, it was the party of Lincoln, you know, which was committed toward the emancipation and the freeing of the blacks. And so that he had the religious belief. He was a Republican, secondly, who believed that that which distinguished the Republican Party and that which gave it a lot of its philosophical base was its commitment to black rights. And it was a party of Lincoln. And then the third factor, I think, was his association with, I think in particular, Simon Sobolov, who had a great influence. Mm-hmm. Upon him. You know, that McKeldin was secretary under Mayor Groening, and Mr. Sobolov, I think, was a young assistant city solicitor. And that's where they first came together, I think, in 27, 28. And I think those factors, as best as I can isolate them, are the three factors that accounted for his unusual commitment. And advocacy and vigorous advocacy of the rights of minorities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he kept it right to the end. I remember when they tried, and it's tangential, but it is connected. When they tried to, Ku Klux Klan, or not Ku Klux Klan, but a group, to try to close down the left wing bookstore over on Park Avenue,
mm-hmm.
not Sherman's, but the
next
one
up the street.
Over, right. I think Lee owns it. Bob Lee, Robert Lee's his name. I was a reporter then. And
66.
That's right. The landlord was under tremendous pressure and all this. And McKeldin called, you know, he called the landlord in and he says, look at you, this is the freedom of expression. I don't agree with the man. But my goodness, we can't permit groups to intimidate others. And regardless of what they believe. And I recall that the New York Times Stringer, who worked at the Evening Sun, was away. So I had to take his place that week, and I wrote the story for the New York Times, and they ran it on page 11 or 12, really, in it, just exactly as I had written it. I really felt flattered that they, and you know, it was a major story about, you know, of a mayor, you know, really taking the side of an unpopular group, but he believed very strong. And I said, you know, he didn't have this great formal academic background. He was what you call really a guts.
A good man.
A guts libertarian.
Yeah.
A good man. Yeah,
yeah.
He didn't have to be taught that. You see.